The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good morning, Gloria, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt, inside the Beltway Live on this Wednesday morning. I'll be in the heart of the mall later today, giving a speech to the NRB's executive committee, and I am going to be wandering around town all day, so I'm looking forward to a very cold and windy fall day in the Beltway. It's actually dropped overnight to 50 degrees. It feels like fall. We could have a football game. Biggest news story, the rundown, biggest news story. You won't see this many places. They don't care. Big media does not want to focus on what I think is an urgent situation because it should embarrass and discredit President Biden and everyone associated with him. Deputy Undersecretary Colin Call went up to testify yesterday in the Senate and confirmed that there are 450 American citizens still trapped in Afghanistan. Here is where he does the math. Cut number two.
In terms of how many American citizens we estimate are currently in Afghanistan, the Department of State is in contact with 196 American citizens who are ready to depart, and arrangements are being made for them to do so either via air or over ground. And another 243 American citizens have been contacted and are not ready to depart, either because they want to stay in Afghanistan or aren't ready.
No, this is the current number. Question.
The remarkable thing, Senator Inhofe, the ranking member of defense, dragged that out, Colin Call. The key thing is, why did we get told there were only 100? And where are these people and what is happening to them? And when you say they would like to leave and they're making preparations to, what the hell does that mean? We've got American citizens in Afghanistan. There were supposed to be around 100, already more than 100 left. So you can see with 450 American citizens now in Afghanistan, they lied to you. They just absolutely lied to you. By the way, they lied to you about the threat of terror and the ability with, quote, over the horizon means to deter it. Colin Call, cut number four.
What I said was that the current intelligence community's assessment is that ISIS-K could potentially develop a capability within 6 to 12 months and that Al-Qaeda could potentially develop that capability within 1 to 2 years. But it's precisely that threat that we need to remain vigilant and disrupt.
How do we determine whether they have the intention or the will to attack once they have the capability to do so?
Well, I think we are actually fairly certain that they have the intention to do so. And I think the committee had the opportunity to hear from the intelligence community in a classified setting not too long ago, and we can follow up in the closed session. But we have considerable evidence that they have the intent. The question at the moment is the capability.
They have the intent to strike the United States again. Maisie Hirono actually did her job, which is to ask a completely, thick-headed question that yielded a better answer than all the prepared people got. Because he said, well, they have the president's intention. He let down his guard because he was talking to Maisie Hirono from Hawaii, and everyone knows she's never going to win the spelling bee. So he let Colin Call let down his guard, and he accidentally let slip. Well, yeah, they have the intention. The intelligence community has told you they intend to hit us, and in 6 months, they'll have that ability. So America, Joe Biden. You go out there and vote for Terry McAuliffe and Joe Biden after last night's rally. There was a, quote, rally. Let me show you a couple of pictures put up by our friend Mac Whitlock. Here is the CBS picture of the rally that the president did with Terry McAuliffe in Virginia last night. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see that picture. I don't see it yet, so maybe it's stuck in the ether. But it looks like a good crowd. You know, you say, well, wow, the president may have more hustle than we think. Maybe he's really good at it. Then you pan out. There's the first picture. That's the CBS News picture. Then you pan out, and they have taken over one corner of one tiny park in Virginia across the river from the White House. And they basically rounded up the locals and shuffled them into maybe 300 people there. Is that 300 people, Dwayne? Do you think that's 300 people? I'm not sure that that's 300 people. But the president, though, is simply out to lunch on this stuff. Here he is last night talking about Glenn Youngkin, who has clearly got the Democrats scared to death of winning an upset that would be an earthquake in America. Cut number 17.
Just to look how he's closing his campaign. He's gone from banning a woman's right to choose to banning books written by a Pulitzer Prize and Nobel Prize winning author Toni Morrison.
So if you he's talking about Beloved, by the way, which I just finished recently, and he's talking about not banning books, but about allowing parents to know which books are being read and what their messages are. Beloved is a fine book for teenagers to read, and I'm sure Glenn Youngkin would agree with that. But if you have to distort what your attacking opponent is saying, then you're responding to attacks 2 days before an election with a weak and unpopular president in a tiny park with nobody in it. And that means Terry McAuliffe is sucking air because people don't like Joe Biden anymore. One other cut, by the way, cut number 18. This is a raise the most eyebrows from last night.
Extremism can come in many forms, can come in the rage of a mob driven to assault the Capitol. It can come in a smile and a fleece vest.
Do you hear someone say,
either way, the big lie is still a big lie.
Yeah, Terry McAuliffe just winced when he said that. Let's play it again. If you're watching on YouTube, watch Terry McAuliffe say, oh, dear, he read that line wrong.
Here in Virginia. Extremism can come in many forms. Can come in the rage of a mob driven to assault the Capitol. It can come in a smile and a fleece vest.
Either way, I'm going to start doing my radio show like Joe Biden, and then I'll do this. Really, this guy is Grandpa at Thanksgiving. It's me in 15 years. I understand that. Mort Saul died last night at the age of 94. So maybe that was on his mind when he was yelling at people. Maybe Joe Biden was saddened by the news of Mort Saul and wanted to do a Mort Saul impersonation. But it's crazy. It's absolutely nuts that Glenn Youngkin has anything to do with January 6th. It's just like the craziest thing possible. It's like saying Mitt Romney and the SDS. You know, it's so stupid. George W. Bush and the Weather Underground. That's what it is. You know, you say, huh? What? What? And he's just nuts. And Virginians, you know the problems with your schools. You know what you've got to do. Here's Britt Hume with Tucker Carlson last night, cut 14.
I think so. I mean, I think he can help. I think even Biden can get down. Look, this is these big names and people like Obama and Biden, they probably can't swing elections, but they can do a couple of things. One is they can usually help you raise money, particularly a sitting president, because people will turn out in numbers and pay a lot of money to go to have dinner with the president, or to be able to say they did and maybe get a picture taken with him. So they're good fundraisers, and they can help turn out crowds. Whether they can swing this election, I don't know. But think of this. Think of this stuff that McAuliffe has been saying. He's made up all kinds of wild numbers about the COVID presence in the state of Virginia and in the schools. He's been slapped down with four Pinocchios from the Washington Post left-leaning fact checker. So this is a man in trouble, and that is why we're seeing all these characters rolling into Virginia to campaign for him. If he loses, if Terry McAuliffe loses, it will be seen as a political earthquake. And if the Democrats weren't already worried about what's going to happen to them in 2022, they will be terrified if that comes about. Look, the fact that the race is even close at all, and it is very close indeed from the polling, ought to be terrifying to Democrats that they're on the wrong course and need to change. Doubt they will, but that ought to be the message.
You know, yesterday the Biden administration put out their priority, which is to make sure that there is equity in sentencing decisions and release criminals early. That's the framework that came out from the Biden administration on criminal justice reform, is no bail reform. And this is what the left wants. And Virginia is not left. Virginia is center left. It's not left wing. And most of Virginia is right and center right. So can the northern suburbs turn out a vote? Can they get the African-American population in Richmond and Virginia Beach and throughout the entire Commonwealth to care about Joe Biden? I don't think so. We will see on Wednesday of next week, a week from today. Joe Manchin's machinations reach a crescendo as he distances himself from his party. Manchin, I think we'll get to a framework deal. New cases are down by 60%, and we've got Hollywood celebrities campaigning for child vaccines. That's good. Get your kid vaccinated if there's no underlying condition as soon as it's possible. Countries are reopening border, not China. More than 130,000 U.S. lives could have been saved with quicker action, according to Birx. I don't know how quicker you get the vaccine out than Operation Warp Speed. Countries are reopening borders. China isn't ready to do so. And Republican senators are introducing a bill to block the opening of a Palestinian consulate in Jerusalem. It really is crazy what the Biden administration is doing after the Abraham Accords showed the way. Google nearly doubles its profit. And we'll talk about that when I review market stories next. Don't go anywhere. Putin and Al Gore in Glasgow for the summit. Al Gore is raising money. Putin is raising eyebrows. I'll tell you all about it as the Hugh Hewitt Show on Wednesday morning continues. Stay with us.
Hi, it's Hugh Hewitt for Birch Gold. If you found yourself completely befuddled by events in Afghanistan, alarmed about inflation and otherwise uneasy, well, about everything, about Americans standing in the world, about what comes next, then you're feeling like everybody else is, and uncertainty is usually a time that you want to increase your holdings in gold. When I do that, I do it with Birch Gold. I buy my gold from Birch Gold. You can go to HughGold.com or text my name, Hugh, H-U-G-H, to 474747. They will send you free information. If you want to roll over a portion of your IRA or your 401k into physical precious metals, Birch Gold is who to do that with. They have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, countless five-star reviews, thousands of happy customers. If you're thinking, I got to get some gold, do it with Birch Gold via HughGold.com or text my name, Hugh, to 474747. That's Hugh to 474747 or HughGold.com.
Lift his home in Tucson, Arizona, for some California grass.
Welcome back, America. Let It Be remastered out in a new form today, so we'll borrow some bump music from that. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live inside the Beltway on this Wednesday morning, joined by Dimitri Sebastopoulou, who is the U.S.-China correspondent for the Financial Times, who broke the story on China's eye-opening hypersonic missile test 2 weeks ago, then followed with a second scoop on a second missile test. Good morning, Dimitri. Welcome to the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Good morning, Hugh. Thanks for having me.
First, I want people to know they can follow you on Twitter, and they should, at Dimi, D-I-M-I. I want to salute you for getting an actually usable Twitter handle. Did you do that when it launched?
I didn't. Someone else had it, but they never used it. And I petitioned and said, hey, I'm an Irish-Greek guy who would love that handle. Someone else has it, doesn't use it. And Twitter very kindly gave it to me after it had been dormant for a few years.
Well, good for you. Dimi is a great, great Twitter handle. Dimitri, walk us through... Where am I talking to you today? I never know where the Financial Times people are.
So I'm based in Washington D.C., just out in the suburbs of the swamp.
I probably go past you on the bike path every day. So Dimitri, tell us about the first scoop, then the second scoop, and the reaction. I brought it up at the Senate debate on Sunday night in Ohio among the six Republican candidates, and I must say, mm-hmm. none of them are really aware of its significance.
Well, so what happened was on July 27th, China tested a really interesting capability. They launched a Long March rocket, which is the rocket they often use for their space programs. But on that rocket, they had something called a hypersonic glide vehicle. And the best way to think about that is it's kind of like a space shuttle in the way it flies and maneuvers. The rocket brings the space shuttle or the hypersonic glide vehicle into lower orbit. It went around the Earth. At some point, the glide vehicle detaches from the rocket, and then it sped down towards its target. We're told that it missed its target by a couple of dozen miles. But what was significant was it was the first time that China used this technology to go around the Earth once. And something that they did during that flight, and we still don't know what it is, really freaked people out at the Pentagon because they don't know how China managed to accomplish whatever capability it was. So it really, really stunned people because they thought, here's just a really, really good example again of where China is making massive, fast developments in its military program that for some reason, year after year after year, keeps stunning the U.S. military and intelligence establishment. And then the second test we have to know less about, but on August 13th, there was a second test of some kind of a hypersonic weapon, and we're still trying to get some of the details on this. But what's really interesting is literally about half an hour ago, just before we came on, General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, has actually become the first American official to confirm this. And in an interview on Bloomberg Television, he said, I'm quoting, "What we saw was a very significant event of a test of a hypersonic weapon." He said, "I don't know if it's quite a Sputnik moment, but I think it's very close to that. It has all of our attention." So this is a big deal. And this is the first U.S. government confirmation that China did this.
Wow. You are way ahead of the curve, Dmitry. And so congratulations on the scoop. Now, if Mark Milley is out there saying that this is a significant moment, I don't know if it's a Sputnik moment, that means it is a Sputnik moment. And that means we don't have anything to do about it, right? We have no defense against this.
Yeah. So the interesting thing about, the U.S., Russia, China are all developing different kinds of hypersonic weapons. And, hypersonic weapons are basically weapons that can travel at 5 times the speed of sound and beyond. And they can go much faster than that as well. What makes them really interesting and important and very concerning for the U.S. is that they're maneuverable. They're a bit like a cruise missile, but they can go much further and faster. And you can change direction, you can change trajectory. So if you had a Chinese hypersonic missile or one of these glide vehicles that came into the atmosphere and started coming down towards Los Angeles or Washington, D.C. or wherever, it's much, much harder for any kind of missile defense system to target and intercept the incoming missile, because it can maneuver, it can fly around. And, U.S. missile defense systems have been developed for a long time, even in tests where the military knows the launch point, the trajectory, the timing and everything. They still only have, I think slightly over 50% success rate in intercepting incoming missiles. So if you have something that you don't know the timing until it's been launched, it can maneuver as it's coming close to its target, it's a big deal. And the other thing that China demonstrated in this test, they used an old technology that the Soviets actually developed in the 60s, deployed for a while, and then stopped after some arms controls agreement came into place with the U.S. And essentially, it allows missiles to come in over the South Pole. And the vast majority of U.S. missile defenses are actually aimed at missiles, essentially rogue states, North Korea, Iran, missiles coming in over the North Pole. So if you've got something coming in over the South Pole that when it comes close to its target can actually maneuver and fly around things and try and evade incoming interceptor missiles, it's a really big deal. And it gives China just one more weapon in its arsenal that, the U.S. now has to think about in a way that 5 years ago it wasn't having to spend a lot of time thinking about.
It greatly complicates everything in terms of missile defense. Ohio, along with Wisconsin and Michigan, were attempting to bid. Ohio at its Ravenna Armory were attempting to get the next phased array of missile defense put in there. I don't know that that even makes a lick of sense anymore if we're looking in 5 years at a hypersonic China that can come in over the South Pole. All those sites were being studied because of their utility against North Pole missiles. Now they can come over the South Pole. Talking to Dmitry Sebastopoulos of the Financial Times, I want to play you, Dmitry, Jake Sullivan yesterday at a White House presser, cut number 6.
From the U.S. president's perspective, President Biden does believe it's important that he have the opportunity to have a face-to-face engagement with Xi Jinping. And if it's not possible in person because of Xi's travel constraints, doing it by a virtual meeting is the next best thing. That's what we're intending to do. And we're intending to do that because in an era of intense competition between the U.S. and China, intense diplomacy at the highest levels, leader-level diplomacy, is vital to effectively managing this relationship.
Now, I appreciate that Jake Sullivan wants a meeting between Xi and Biden for the benefit of Joe Biden. But Dmitry, isn't that embarrassing to have to sort of ask for it at a press conference in the White House?
Well, so I think one of the interesting things that happened this year is that the Biden administration, when it came in, kind of played tough and said, we're not going to talk to the Chinese just for the sake of holding talks. We want to make ourselves stronger at home before we engage with them. They decided about 6 months in that they actually wanted to talk to the Chinese at the leader level, because lower level conversations between, Secretary of State Tony Blinken and Jake Sullivan, who you just rolled the tape on, and their Chinese counterparts, basically produced nothing concrete. that the U.S. was happy about. So they decided to try and do this this meeting with Xi Jinping. But the Chinese were a little bit reluctant at the beginning. They were kind of giving the U.S. a taste of their own medicine. So I think now we're in a place where I think actually both leaders want to talk. But the really important question is, what are they going to achieve? You know, what does the U.S. actually want to get out of China? What are Biden's goals when he talks to Xi Jinping? And can they be effective? And I think just to circle back to how this links into the hypersonic weapons test is, you know, China has, or the U.S. clearly still has more leverage over China than vice versa, but that kind of gap is shrinking. And I think these kind of tests just reinforce that the U.S. in some areas is losing leverage, and which makes it a much more complicated problem for, frankly, for any American president to deal with. And, you know, right now, we've got a very tense situation over Taiwan, which I'm sure we'll talk about. And so all of these things tie together, and I think it's a pretty dangerous period.
It's very, very dangerous period of time, and it's going to be that way. We're in the second Cold War. I talked about this with Dr. Jerry Hendricks. Captain Hendricks is a naval historian and has written extensively on hypersonic. It's very destabilizing, but there's only really one response, which is you got to get your own hypersonics. And Demetrius Sevastopoulos, where is the United States hypersonic effort? There was a big push at the end of the Trump administration to overcome institutional obstruction within the Pentagon to hypersonic development, and they finally rolled over ESPR, who didn't get it, and they got it going. What's going on?
So I think, you know, I think there's a recognition on the U.S. side that while in many, many, many areas, the U.S. is still ahead of China in its military capabilities, that hypersonics is one of the areas where China is making big advances. And, you know, there is money starting to flow into it. I think the U.S. was relatively slow, and the Russians and Chinese got a, I think, had the edge. And I think this test is just is going to reinforce calls for basically the Pentagon to spend more money on missile defense, to spend more money on hypersonic weapon development. And I think also Congress is going to be much more willing to provide the money to do that. So I think in that sense, the Chinese test is probably a game changer.
Yeah, there is a real missile gap, unlike the 1960 gap invented by Jack Kennedy to campaign against Nixon and Eisenhower by extension. There is a real missile gap right now. So, Dmitry, last question. You anticipated it correctly. The Center for New American Security put out a war game yesterday. We lose on a Taiwan conflict. Again, we always lose on a Taiwan conflict. Admiral Stavridis confirmed that for me. Taiwan has been under increasing pressure. The Olympics are coming up. Everyone has Sochi Olympics in the back of their mind. And 4 years ago, right after they closed, Putin marched into Crimea and took a lot of eastern Ukraine. What is the sense around the Pentagon about the urgency of the defense of Taiwan issue? And what about Joe Biden's blunder and walk back last week?
Well, so at the Pentagon, I think there's mixed views. So Admiral Davidson, who was the head of Indo-Pacific Command until just before the summer, he said in March that he thought that China would take military action against Taiwan within 6 years. General Mark Milley, who we just talked about, you know, he's more sanguine, says, no, they're not ready. It's not going to happen soon. But then there's a range of views in between. And I think there's a sense that while Xi Jinping is probably not going to do something over the next year because he's gearing up for what the Chinese call the 20th Party Congress, where he's expected to get an unprecedented third term as the leader of the Communist Party and the president of China, it would be highly unlikely that he does something before that. But I think people are worried about after the Beijing Olympics in February, after the Party Congress at the end of next year, does Xi Jinping then feel emboldened to do something? You know, a lot of people will push back and say it would be too detrimental to the Chinese economy. He's not going to take the risk. But then others will say, well, look at Hong Kong and how quickly Xi Jinping has cracked down on Hong Kong. There are other places where people didn't expect China to do what it's done so quickly. And therefore, you have to be even more vigilant about Taiwan. And you can't assume that nothing's going to happen. So I think that there's real concern about that. I'm sorry, what was the part of the question?
We're out of time, Dimmy. So I will just say that Taiwan issue should be front and center for everyone because General Secretary Xi has ambitions like Joe Biden, but his ambitions are to be Mao and Joe Biden's ambitions is to be FDR. We don't need FDR. We need Winston Churchill and Reagan right now. And Dimi, you are very crucial to that. Dimitri Sevastopoulou, thank you. Come back from the Financial Times. And if you're not a subscriber to the Financial Times, you're missing the very best in investigative reporting at the Pentagon and reporting on national security from Dimitri. Time for me, though, to tell you about this. BeliefFactor.com. I already told you heading down to the mall today to give a speech at lunch, and I'm really looking forward to the speech. But it also, I like walking around the mall, so I'm going to go early and do it there. Ikerian Kirkeman, what in the heck? This thing is falling. No, it's falling around here. It's not resveratrol. It's the four pilser. Down the hatch goes Relief Factor. Go get it. Take it. Wander around the mall with me at 11 o'clock or wander anywhere you want. Activity is life. All right. You got to get moving. I'm going to be talking with Roth Douthat later today about this book, The Deep Places, which is it's an alarming book. It's about chronic illness. It's about when Ross got Lyme disease. It's about pain. And about how pain affects everybody's daily life. And he tried everything. And I want to ask him if he tried ReliefFactor.com because he got better. But boy, you never want to get Lyme's disease. You really don't. I'll be right back, America. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. Go get your ReliefFactor.com. Morning glory, America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt live inside the Beltway. Standing by for the next governor of Virginia, Glenn Youngkin. Is barnstorming out there, and I look forward to talking to him about the message in the crowds. It looks very good for Glenn Youngkin right now, even though it's a big ask to take a state that voted for Joe Biden by 10 points and flip it red. But the Virginia school issue is all-encompassing. As Virginia's schools go, so goes the country school. And if the moms of Virginia and their husbands and their adult children get out and vote for Glenn Youngkin, the absurd school policies on CRT, but more importantly on the quarantine and COVID, will change and we will get to normalcy and children will not be abandoned to the vicissitudes of educrats across the country. But you need to get Glenn Youngkin elected. Now, Glenn Youngkin was attacked last night by Joe Biden in loud, crazy terms that immediately lit up the internet. Just as I was going to bed, I see that everybody is talking about Joe Biden going way over the top into hysterical shouting. And this is what the president said last night about Glenn Youngkin, who's a center-right, amiable, very smart fellow. Cut number 17.
Just to look how he's closing his campaign. He's gone from banning a woman's right to choose to banning books written by a Pulitzer Prize and Nobel Prize winning author, Toni Morrison.
Of course, the Glenn Youngkin has not proposed that. He also was attacked this way by Joe Biden last night. Cut 18.
Extremism can come in many forms. Can come in the rage of a mob driven to assault the Capitol. It can come in a smile and a fleece vest.
This is the most absurd thing I've heard in the campaign. I am joined now by the next governor of Virginia, Glenn Youngkin. Good morning, Glenn. How are you?
I'm doing great. I've got a smile on and a fleece vest this morning.
I know. You know, I don't let extremists on my radio show. There's never been one on, so I've got to worry about you now. You're about as extremist as Larry Hogan, and everyone in Virginia will understand that immediately. Why is the president shouting at you, Glenn Youngkin?
Well, because it's the last ditch effort of a failing campaign. I mean, they are desperate. You know, Hugh, they're looking at the exact same numbers we are. You know, the polls that everybody's seeing today have us neck and neck, but those are trailing polls, and they're looking at the same internal numbers we are, which we are surging. And the polls are going to be coming out over the next few days are just going to show exactly what's happening is us moving ahead, well ahead. And they're just grasping for their last ditch efforts. They're doing what they only thing they know to do, which is to literally go back to the 43-year playbook that Terry McAuliffe wrote for the Democratic Party. He wrote this. I mean, he's the godfather of all of this. He wrote it. And so they have to go back to their dog whistle issues of accusing people of being extremist and you know, calling us racist and everything else. It's all they got.
And it's not
Virginians
working.
Virginians aren't buying it, Hugh. They're not buying it.
Now, I was explaining to the audience, Glenn Youngkin, that as Virginia's schools go, so will the schools of the rest of the country. In other words, if you arrive in Richmond with the authority and the ability to get schools into a coherent situation, both as to CRT and to COVID, it will spread. It will spread across the country. So it's up to Virginia's moms to put you in. How do you feel about that?
Well, this is the defining issue down the stretch, because at the end of the day, Terry McAuliffe can't explain why he thinks parents shouldn't have a role in their kids' education. He just can't do it because there's no explanation. All he wants is big government to stand between parents and their kids so that they, in fact, can continue to do what the left liberal progressive party wants to do, which is to keep individual rights in the drawer and have big government decide everything. That's what it is. And oh, by the way, Hugh, this education issue flies right in the face of the entire left establishment. I mean, it's not just big government. It's Hollywood. It's everybody else. And so this is why down the stretch here, this basic issue of parents having a fundamental right to be engaged in their kids' education is one that Terry McAuliffe can't explain, because he knows the answer is just so offensive to so many people, why he thinks big government should impose on parents' rights and why parents are all standing up with us. I mean, this is not a campaign. It is a movement now.
It is a movement. And I was called last night by my daughter, who saw my schedule, and said, please ask Glenn Youngkin if he will get the Virginia schools some common sense on COVID. Now, two of my three grandchildren have COVID, but the oldest one, who hasn't and has tested negative four times, can't go to school for 24 days in Virginia. And so I'm curious, Glenn Youngkin, have you heard the quarantine rules along with the CRT in Loudoun County, along with the attempt to marginalize parents at Terry McAuliffe? Have you heard that the COVID rules are driving moms crazy?
Yeah, I mean, parents have had it. They've just had it across the board. I mean, think about it. You had started with parents standing up for one simple basic request: open our schools. And last spring, the left liberal progressive leaders wouldn't open the schools when we saw schools open across the country and Virginia's kids were falling behind. And then all of a sudden they got to see during this pandemic what was being taught to their children and said, wait a minute, you're teaching my children what to think? No. You got to teach my kids how to think. That's my goal. It's my right to tell my kids and discuss at dinner tables what we think as a family. And then all of a sudden, here we have the schools again. I had parents yesterday walking up, I got to get my kids back in school, please. They're being sent home for no reason. At the end of the day, Hugh, this is fundamentally about parents' rights. And Terry McAuliffe doesn't believe that parents should have any. And it's not about anything else. They're going to conflate this issue with a whole bunch of other topics because it's all they've got. And let me just be really clear. Parents have a fundamental right to be engaged in their kids' education, and Terry McAuliffe doesn't believe so.
That is what he said he's attempted to run away from. It's always a good rule of thumb that if your opponent is talking about you and your arguments on the closing stretch, you, Glenn Youngkin, are winning. Now, over the weekend, I don't know what they're going to hit male TV with. I saw President Obama pop up during the Browns game on Thursday night, so I'm sure they're flooding the airwaves. But you have got a bus tour going. I don't know where you are today. Your schedule's remarkable, and poor Terry McAuliffe is limping around the Virginia Arlington Park, which is 5 minutes from the White House, and calling it a campaign stop. And they barely had 1,000 people there. I think they had 300 people there. What do you do in the final days with the weekend ahead of you, with the last sprint ahead of you?
Well, we're on day five of a 10-day bus tour, and it is so much fun, Hugh. First of all, the crowds are huge, and today we're in Roanoke, and we travel around Roanoke. We end up in Christiansburg tonight. The crowds are huge, and I'm meeting with voters, and it's not just Republicans. It's independents. It's Democrats. I mean, Hugh, we are winning the independents by double digits. Democrats are literally flocking to our side, and this is because we're talking about the issues that are most important to Virginians. Yes, schools and parents' rights, but also low taxes and the best jobs and safe communities. And oh, by the way, how about government that works for us and doesn't tell us what to do all the time? This is what Virginians want to talk about. And this is why Terry McAuliffe, all he can do is bring in another personality after another personality, throw rock concerts or anything he can do in order to try to get people to show up. But people are not showing up for him because there's no energy, there's no enthusiasm, and there's no desire to have Terry McAuliffe back as their next governor.
Now, we cover Virginia with this show, so I want to know, is early voting still underway in Virginia? I voted for you for weeks ago. I'm a Virginian. I voted for you weeks ago. Is early voting like IU still available to people?
It is. Early voting is still available. Please come vote. It'll be open through into the weekend, but then it'll stop on Monday, and then we'll have the final day on Tuesday, November 2nd. And I invite everybody to come out and vote. What we're seeing in early voting is that turnout from Terry's supporters is way down. It's much lower than anybody could have possibly anticipated. turnout for me continues to be strong. And it's just showing up in every single aspect of this race, from polls to early voting to enthusiasm and events. And there's something big happening. We're about to make a huge statement that Virginians are going to stand up and make a big change for a new day, for a day where Virginia soars and doesn't settle. And that's what Virginians are after.
If you campaign like a king, as Terry McAuliffe has, you end up being a beggar of votes on Tuesday. And that's what's going to happen. I mean, he just thought he was going to walk into this race, Glenn Youngkin. So my last question to you is, in terms of what you can do quickly about the schools, because, you know, you got the Loudoun County violence, the assaults inside of school bathrooms. You've got the CRT issues all over the state. You've got the quarantine. How quickly can you move on the education front when you win, if people turn out and vote for you on Tuesday?
Well, quickly, we're going to announce a new Secretary of Education and a new superintendent, state superintendent of the schools, by December 1st. We're actually going to call for a task force of school leaders, teachers, students, parents, law enforcement to be convened and meet during December and January and add to our day one plan. But our day one plan is really clear. On day one, we're going to raise expectations. We're going to make sure that schools are well-funded. We're going to raise teacher pay. We're going to fund into crumbling buildings. We're going to fund into special education. We're going to press forward and launch our charter school initiative, which is for 20 new innovation charter schools on day one. And we're going to work on curriculum on day one. And we are going to, in fact, change curriculum. We're not going to allow critical race theory in our schools. And we're going to teach all history going forward.
Glenn Youngkin, great to have you on. I'll talk to you again before the campaign wraps up on Tuesday a couple of times, I hope. Hey, Virginians, get out and vote early today. I've already voted. Go vote for Glenn Youngkin. Do your part to turn Virginia around and get the schools back to common sense curriculum and back getting kids into classes. I'll be right back on the Hugh Hewitt Show. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home, or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-888-1172. Welcome back, America. Let It Be album being re-released today, redone and all that kind of stuff. 53 years old, so it's older than Mike Gallagher, congressman extraordinaire from Wisconsin. It's about as old as Aaron Rodgers and about as relevant as the Packers' chances this year's Super Bowl, where the Browns will be at SoFi Stadium in L.A. in February. But Congressman Gallagher is smart, is up to speed on hypersonics. Good morning, Congressman. You heard about General Milley? I tried to avoid hitting you with direct assault and giving you a chance to respond.
I appreciate that. I did hear about General Milley's comments. I'm glad that he's talking about this in the serious terms it demands. It also confirms Dimitri's reporting and the Financial Times article. And my hope is that General Milley is being very clear in his meetings with the White House about the nature of this test, the implications, and therefore about the nuclear posture review and the missile defense review, because the Biden administration has said in its interim national security strategy that they actually want to reduce the role of our nuclear forces in our security. Well, China certainly feels different about its security. It's made massive investments in its nuclear capabilities, to say nothing about the conventional applications of this weapon. But the point is that they aren't disinvesting in their defense like the Biden administration seems to want to do. Quite the opposite. We are asleep at the wheel. I fear at the same time we're getting ready to spend trillions of dollars on domestic progressive programs, we are unwilling to spend the minimum necessary to avoid World War III, to defend Taiwan. And that's the final thing I'd say, Hugh. I think it's useful to view all of this through the prism of a Taiwan scenario, because you start to dig into what this means. The fractional orbital bombardment system China demonstrated, it's not necessarily a precision weapon in this case. It's an area weapon meant to take out a large target like an oil refinery or a weapons manufacturing center domestically in the United States. It's meant to intimidate a civilian population. It's trying to get us to sit out the invasion of Taiwan. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to demonstrate that they can hit us at home. And that's why they did this test in a way that everyone could see it, to send that very dangerous message.
So I want to play for the audience that wasn't listening last hour when I interviewed Financial Times correspondent Dimitri Savastopoulou from the Pentagon about what General Milley said earlier today, or it was released today, to David Rubenstein on Bloomberg. Cut number 21, General Milley.
Well, what you saw, and I don't want to get too much into the classification of what we saw, but what we saw was a very significant event of a test of a hypersonic weapon system. And it is very concerning. I think I saw in some of the newspapers they used the term Sputnik moment. I don't know if it's quite a Sputnik moment, but I think it's very close to that. So it's a very significant technological event that occurred, or test that occurred by the Chinese. And it has all of our attention, and we're paying it. But that's just one weapon system. The Chinese military capabilities are much greater than that. They're expanding rapidly in space, in cyber, and then in the traditional domains of land, sea, and air. And they have gone from a peasant-based infantry army that was very, very large in 1979 to a very capable military that covers all the domains and has global ambitions. So China is very significant on our horizon.
But can I presume that the United States has thought of doing a hypersonic missile as well, and that we are not caught completely flat-footed in our ability to maybe produce something like that ourselves?
We are clearly experimenting and testing and developing technologies to include hypersonics, artificial intelligence, robotics, and a whole wide range. Now, if you take a step back, what we're in history-wise, is we're in one of the most significant changes in what I call the character of war. But today, with the introduction of precision munitions, the ability to see all over the world, artificial intelligence, robotics, hypersonics, all of these things together, this is an enormous change in the character of war, and we're going to have to adjust our military going forward.
Now, Mike Gallagher, when the chairman of the Joint Chiefs says that the CCP's army, the PLA and the PLAN, covers all the domains and has global ambitions, but does it in tones that aren't alarming, I'm not sure he's not mixing his messages. He ought to be saying, this is a Sputnik moment. We need more money. We need more resources. Did you hear that in his voice?
I did not. And I think, as Jerry Hendricks has pointed out, we need to understand that it's worse than Sputnik, because we're farther behind than we were on Sputnik, where we were only 6 months away from our first Atlas ICBM launch in 1957. Today, we're not going to be able to get hypersonics in the field until late 22 or early 23. The Raytheon CEO just said we're lagging behind China in hypersonics for years. I would also say there's another key difference that gets to your point, Hugh. If you examine the historical record in the late 50s, the public reaction to Sputnik, both Sputnik 1 and Sputnik 2, varied between measured anxiety and total hysteria. I mean, a lot of what Eisenhower did in the days and weeks following Sputnik was to calm the public and actually harness a lot of the demand for enhanced defense spending in a productive and not wasteful direction. Though it did force them to reevaluate certain assumptions underlining their U.S. national security policy, it didn't force a massive course change in the way that the metaphor has been used. Eisenhower had been expecting the launch, but was taken aback by the weight of the satellite. The difference today is it just doesn't seem to be having that galvanizing effect, either within the administration and certainly within the broader public. And I think that puts a greater set of responsibilities on public officials, whether it's Milley, whether it's a mid-ranking congressman like me, and certainly if it's the president of the United States, to really talk to the American people about why this is important, why we are falling behind China, and why we can't fall any further behind, and by extension, why the defense of Taiwan is so very important. The president last week in a town hall obviously misspoke on a variety of issues, did not seem to be with it. You know, perhaps the one moment of clarity, accidental though it may have been, was on Taiwan, when he said, we are committed to the defense of Taiwan. They shouldn't have walked it back, as they subsequently did, because strategic ambiguity, which is our policy right now, I think is doing us a disservice. So I just haven't seen the sense of urgency from this administration that I think we need, because I think things are going to get very, very dangerous right after the Olympics in early 22.
Yeah, Dmitry was saying, well, most of the Pentagon think it's going to be after the party Congress that reelects him in late in the year to a third unprecedented term as president of China post Mao. I don't think so. I think it's after the people go home and they've got their PR win. Defense Undersecretary Colin Kahl was on the Hill yesterday getting questions from senators about Afghanistan. Here is one of his answers to Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma, cut number two.
In terms of how many American citizens we estimate are currently in Afghanistan, the Department of State is in contact with 196 American citizens who are ready to depart, and arrangements are being made for them to do so either via air or over ground. And another 243 American citizens have been contacted and are not ready to depart, either because they want to stay in Afghanistan or aren't ready.
No,
this is the current
number. So 439 Americans sit still there. He goes on to talk about the ISIS and Al-Qaeda threat. Cut number four from Undersecretary Kahl.
What I said was that the current intelligence community's assessment is that ISIS-K could potentially develop a capability within 6 to 12 months, and that Al-Qaeda could potentially develop that capability within 1 to 2 years. But it's precisely that threat that we need to remain vigilant and disrupt.
How do we determine whether they have the intention or the will to attack once they have the capability to do so?
Well, I think we are actually fairly certain that they have the intention to do so. And I think the committee had the opportunity to hear from the intelligence community in a classified setting not too long ago, and we can follow up in the closed session. But we have considerable evidence that they have the intent. The question at the moment is the capability.
God bless Mazie Hirono, Congressman Gallagher, because she's never going to win the spelling bee, but sometimes she blunders into a question that disarms a colleague. And they say, well, you folks just got briefed that they have the intention. We know they have the intention to hit the United States. And now we think they get the capability in 6 months, and there are 460 plus Americans there. Were you surprised by any of this yesterday?
Well, I was a little bit surprised by the clarity that Kahl offered, because we got a different message when he and others were briefing us during the surrender in Afghanistan. And the message was really twofold. It was the Taliban is evaluating its relationship with Al-Qaeda. That's bogus. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda's relationship has been consistently cooperative for years. When questioned by me, the CENTCOM commander, General McKenzie, said he didn't know if Al-Qaeda had sworn bayat or official allegiance to the Taliban, which, of course, it has and has reaffirmed in recent years. And then the other sort of meta narrative was this idea that ISIS-K and the Taliban's going to take care of ISIS-K for us, which, though these groups compete, though at times they fight each other, I think is a complete fantasy. And I think it's quite dangerous to have gotten ourselves in a position where we're entirely dependent on the Taliban for our counterterrorism strategy in Afghanistan. And so this threat is only going to get worse. The fact that we are putting all our eggs in the basket of over the horizon counterterrorism is foolhardy, as illustrated by the tragic drone strike that killed 10 Afghan civilians on our way out the door. There are severe limits to over the horizon strikes, in large part because it's very difficult to generate intelligence on the ground that is necessary to do precision strikes. And our human networks in particular are entirely compromised because our presence no longer exists in Afghanistan. And so I think this administration is operating under a set of naive assumptions regarding the Taliban in order to justify what was a humiliating surrender and a fiasco for U.S. foreign policy, one that continues to undermine our deterrent posture, not only in the Middle East, but all over the world.
The political needs of the president, particularly in Virginia, where Glenn Youngkin is beating Terry McAuliffe and will scare away people from his FDR fantasy. But the political needs of the president are obliging the administration to downplay what happened in Afghanistan. Do you think that the public is aware of what happened, how many citizens are still there, and the threats that are emerging? You got a minute, Mike.
Yes, I think the Biden administration made the cynical political calculation that Americans don't care about Afghanistan. And maybe most Americans wanted to get out, but Americans don't like to be humiliated. Americans don't want the American government to abandon American citizens. And I think, therefore, it is backfiring. so important to elect Glenn Youngkin in Virginia, even for those of us who don't live in Virginia, because by electing Glenn Youngkin, not only are you helping the state of Virginia fix education, you could be dealing a death blow to this radical progressive agenda that is bad for America. If Youngkin wins, I think it forces the Democrats to reevaluate going full force behind Bernie Sanders' budget and his agenda here at the federal level. So critical.
Mike Gallagher, always good to talk to you, Congressman. Thank you for good common sense conservatism every day, every week that he's on. And he's representing Wisconsin, but speaking to Virginia voters right there, go vote for Glenn Youngkin. Welcome back, America, from Let It Be, the album being re-released today in anticipation of the new Beatles song. Brian Westbury may be almost old enough to really love the Beatles. I'm not sure, but it's kind of fun to have the new edition of Let It Be. Brian, good morning to you. I tweeted last night a Washington Post story that is about the Democrats' tax on billionaires targeting the 10 wealthiest Americans. Now, I actually think that's unconstitutional. That's a bill of attainder that is prohibited by the Constitution. I don't think it will fly. In fact, I'm beginning to think the whole thing is going to be unconstitutional because they're targeting 10 companies and 10 people. What do you think about that as an economic matter?
Yeah, well, first of all, I agree about the constitutionality. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a constitutional scholar, but that was the first thing I thought. This is crazy. If you actually own, like, let's just say you were a trillionaire rancher, all right, and you own cattle, you own land, you own and you own sheep, and then Janet Yellen wanted to come and take 2% away of your wealth away. What would she start doing? Like taking away the legs of the cattle, the corner piece of this land, you know, make a new fence. What would she do with all that? And this is no, I mean, I'm not trying to be humorous about this. This is really serious. You're taking away the thing that creates the wealth. And then let's just go even further. Let's just say, okay, all we're going to do is take away the stock that they own. We don't want the legs of the cattle. We just want the pieces of paper of the stock and the capital gains that they made. And really what they're going after is unrealized gains. So they haven't even been, you know, nobody's made anything yet. Well, this is interesting because interest rates are so low that for the foreseeable future, there will be no capital gains for anybody that owns, let's say, a treasury bond. There were capital gains back in the 80s and 90s. Now there won't be any penalty for owning government debt, but there's a penalty for owning private equity or shares of stock. So really, this is a tax on only the wealth that is put into private companies.
Interesting. Brian, that's amazing. I hadn't thought about that. The other thing I thought about is if someone's got 100 acres of land and you come and you take the government takes 2 acres of that land, it's called a taking. It's prohibited by the Constitution unless it's compensated. So it is clearly in the framers' intent, banning bills of attainder and obliging property takings to be compensated, that this sort of thing not happen. Can you imagine George Washington, who was one of the, if not the largest landowner at the time of his death in the new United States of America as president? He was a large landowner as well. If him saying a bill targeting land ownership, that's what this bill does, and the country won't grow. It's crazy.
No. Yeah, it will not. I mean, one of my tweets over the weekend or over early this week was, if you want to, you know how to get rid or eliminate capital gains, tax them. That's why they tax cigarettes. That's why they tax, you raise taxes to get rid of things. And that's what they want to, I guess Janet Yellen doesn't like capital gains. And so, yes, I think this is unconstitutional. I think it's but clearly it would favor government debt. By the way, they do that already. If a bank buys a government bond, it doesn't have to put capital aside because the Treasury assumes that the government bond is risk free. But if you put if you buy a corporate bond, let's say it's Apple, you have to put a percentage of money of your capital away to offset any loss. It's kind of like a down payment. And so what they do is they encourage banks to buy Treasury debt, not corporate debt. So everything they're doing favors the government, punishes success in the private sector, and it would be a complete disaster.
Brian, very quickly, and unintended consequences. A law this complex that we haven't seen, how likely is it to hit targets it does not intend to hit?
Oh, well, I mean, 1,000%. It will hit targets that we don't foresee.
Yeah, my friend Hank Adler writes about this all the time for Bloomberg and for town halls. His CPA is a professor of accounting now. They never get it right. And we don't see the bill, so the accountants can't weigh in, and Brian Westbury can't weigh in, but he just did. This is a terrible bill. And Democrats, if you're thinking about doing it, you're going to A, fly in the face of constitutional norm, and B, wreck the economy. But Brian Westbury, you're a common sense conservative. They won't listen to you or to me. But I'll be back in hour three to talk to you, America, about why you got to get out and vote for Glenn Youngkin, why you got to buy Ross Douthat's new book, The Deep Places, and why you got to keep listening to The Hugh Hewitt Show. Stay tuned.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never before seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.